It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our Wisconsin Legend series. We'll talk to actor and singer Tom Wopat.
First, though, the 2013 G20 Leader Summit began today in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Leaders from the world's wealthiest countries have gathered for a two-day meeting that, until about a week ago, was supposed to focus on economic growth and trade relations.
However, it looks like this year, the debate over military action in Syria might be overshadowing economic issues, and as the Syria issue has strained an already tense relationship between the U.S. and Russia, eyes are on President Obama and Vladimir Putin to see how that tension plays out.
Josh Gerstein joins us now. He's senior White House reporter at Politico. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you.
So timing here for this G20 summit, bit awkward for President Obama, giving all the Syria international debate going on. What does he have to worry about going into this conference?
Well, I mean, the main concern is that he's on Russian President Vladimir Putin's home turf, that Putin has to some extent control over the agenda and particularly the mechanics of, what's going to take place in front of the cameras and behind the cameras. And so it's just very awkward since Putin has been the main thorn in the side of the U.S. in trying to take some action in the Syria crisis.
This is, as I mentioned, supposed to be an economic summit. I assume that people are still going to be meeting on the economy. Is anybody really focusing on that in the coverage you're seeing on this?
Well, in the coverage, no, although there are, of course, financial news outlets that are always focused on the minutiae of any, currency moves, trade moves, or things of that sort. But it was said explicitly by Putin at the first session earlier today that they would, at a working dinner the leaders are having this evening, talk about the issue of Syria and, formally put that on the agenda. Up till that point, it wasn't clear if it would just be an issue talked about in the hallways or actually part of the formal meeting.
Is that something that President Obama wants to see happen?
You know, it's unclear. The White House said that they weren't among the countries that asked that it be added to the formal agenda. I think the White House knew that it was inevitable that there would be some discussion of the subject. But my impression going into the meeting was that the U.S. was hoping to keep it as much as possible to the economic issues because of their concern that if it really turned to Syria in a substantial way, Russia would be there to object to whatever the U.S. was saying. And the truth is that the lineup of countries there is not particularly aligned with the U.S., at least on the question of whether there should be a military response to the use of chemical weapons in Syria.
So after some back and forth, is President Obama going to end up meeting with President Putin at any point, one-on-one?
I think it's likely that they'll have conversations. The White House has been pretty clear that there's no intention to have any type of formal meeting. They have announced formal meetings with the Japanese Prime Minister, the German Chancellor, and the Chinese President. But Putin is being, notably omitted from that list, and people are probably aware that there was supposed to be, prior to this summit, a meeting between Obama and Putin in Moscow, and President Obama canceled that a month or so ago, partially over the Edward Snowden leaks matter, but generally over a lack of progress and a lack of seeing eye to eye in the U.S.-Russia relationship.
Human rights in Russia have been a concern. Is President Obama going to try to cast a light on that at all?
Well, he will, and, maybe a little bit of a pushback towards Putin trying to stir up trouble on the Syria issue. The president is set meetings tomorrow on Friday. I think one meeting basically with what they call civil society representatives, largely human rights activists, including a couple of activists from Russia's lesbian and gay community that has been particularly in the news in the last few months over a new Russian law that makes it illegal to to put forward any type of what they view as pro-gay propaganda, and concerns that even, say, in the Olympics next year, this could be a problem for some of the athletes there, depending on how that law is going to be enforced.
Well, with all the talk over Syria, do you see Syria as a symptom of a problem with U.S.-Russian relations, or is it a cause of a breakdown in relations?
Well, I'd say it's part of the cause. It's one of the major impediments in that relationship. There are some areas where there is a fair amount of agreement between the U.S. and Russia. I think the countries have been working together fairly well on some international arms control issues, on issues like North Korea and Iran, for example. The U.S. and Russia have been seeing eye to eye. But this Syria thing has been really a major, major obstacle in the relationship. It's not just that the U.S. and Russia don't have the same view on what should happen, but in fact, the U.S. position is that Syria is basically fueling the violence there that is really providing a financial and a military lifeline for the Assad regime, and that the Russia is essentially complicit in everything that's been taking place in Syria over the last couple of years.
And President Putin has been supportive of Syria, and that's kind of their foothold, isn't it, in the Middle East? That's why it's such a big deal for Russia.
Yeah, a lot of people refer to Syria as a client state of Russia. You know, it's clearly an independent country, but there's just a long historical relationship and tie between the two countries. And it's interesting because the Russians and Putin often try to portray this as sort of a bulwark against Islamic extremism, that, you know, if they give in here and give in to the opposition, there's going to be some kind of an implosion, and that at the end of the day, the extremists are going to end up in control, much as they did in Afghanistan, for example, after the Soviet invasion there went sour and the Soviets pulled out. And so that's the way Putin tries to turn the argument around on the U.S.
You mentioned President Obama meeting with leaders from, I think it was China, Japan, and Germany. Are these trade talks, or is this again going to be trying to wrangle for either support or at least non-opposition to military action in Syria?
I think it's a little of both. You know, there's a little bit of talking about the economy and the full range of issues between the two countries. You know, even those countries, not totally, supportive. I think the French, for example, are supportive of the U.S. position on this. But among other countries, even Germany has said they don't plan to take part in any military action. The Japanese, I think, have said that they support some kind of an international response, but won't say more than that. And I doubt, given their history, that they would be at the forefront of pressing for a military response. And then China's position on the substance here has been basically the same as Russia. And what's so interesting about that is that the U.S. is really beating up the Russians over this, calling them, basically accusing them of holding the United Nations hostage over this issue. China has taken the same substantive position at the U.N. and has done it basically without public complaint from the United States.
And then another country there, British Prime Minister David Cameron was supportive of military action, but his parliament said no, thanks. Is that going to make things awkward between the president and the prime minister?
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to have a formal meeting or just informal discussions. I don't think it would make it awkward between the two leaders, because the president and the prime minister's position there are the same, but there's no question that just seeing the two men together, it would be a reminder that there's at least the possibility the same thing could happen in the U.S. with President Obama's decision to try to seek a congressional endorsement and ratification of a military strike on Syria, it really being up in the air about whether that will happen, whether Congress will endorse what Obama wants to do or vote against it. And, certainly having Cameron in nearby would make a lot of people at least be reminded of the fact that the same move in Britain didn't go so well for Mr. Cameron.
Now you're covering the White House at home and abroad. President Obama trying to get support from somewhere. At the same time as this is going on, there's wrangling to get Congress to back military action in Syria. Do you think one looms larger for President Obama, international or domestic support?
I think at the moment the domestic fight is probably the bigger fight. I mean, the president can go forward without much more international support than he has right now. I think if you were to have a voting down of a resolution, the defeat of a resolution in Congress to authorize this kind of a mission, I frankly don't think the president would do it. It would be a huge embarrassment and a huge snub to him that I think would probably have some ramifications and repercussions that go well beyond this current Syria crisis. So I do think that's probably job one at the White House right now, but the schedule and the vagaries of, trying to put these things on calendars weeks or months in advance has the president, out of the country doing this diplomatic work right now, making it hard for him to be really burning up the phone lines or having meetings with members of Congress on this issue, though the White House says he has been speaking to members of Congress from his trip to St. Petersburg.
Josh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
That was Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter at Politico.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll continue our Wisconsin Legend series with singer Tom Wopat of Dukes of Hazzard fame. This is Central Time.
It's time to talk about another Wisconsin legend, Tom Wopat. You might remember him from his days as Luke on the Dukes of Hazzard, but since then he's gone on to have an active recording and stage career.
His birthday is next week, so we thought we'd talk to the Wisconsin native about his new album and the latest news from his singing career. His new album is called I've Got Your Number. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, just fine.
I gotta say, I grew up watching the Dukes of Hazzard. I never thought I'd actually get to talk to you.
I can't be held responsible for that.
You don't, seriously, you don't regret those days, do you?
Oh, no, I had a blast. We had a great time, and I ended up directing a half a dozen of them, so I got a little more out of it than just the huge acting skills that we worked on.
Do you ever still give a yee-haw every now and then?
Eh, not much. Snyder now and then. I talked to him yesterday. So, you know, that stuff is all alive and well. The Dukes of Hazzard reunions are a big deal around the country, especially in the South and the Southeast. So I've been doing some of that in the last couple of years.
Nice. Well, you are from Wisconsin, like we just talked about as we introduced you, and you're from Lodi. So where do you live right now? Where are we calling you?
Well, I'm actually in North Jersey right now. I have a little log cabin out here, but I spend most of my time on the Upper West Side in Manhattan.
And you get back to Wisconsin from time to time to perform. I know I've seen your name around on various performing arts bills, right?
Yeah, I try to get there as much as I can, and I've maintained a relationship with Lecrone there at the UW, so I try and do some stuff with him every now and then as well.
And you've got a new album out. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's called I've Got Your Number. And it's kind of a nod to the Mad Men era, the Rat Pack era of the 60s and 70s. And it the instrumentation is a nice little string section and then a pretty big horn section. So it's kind of a big band / orchestra arrangement sort of thing. And we did about half American Songbook tunes. And then we also took songs from people like Paul Simon, Bruce Hornsby, Bruce Springsteen, Judy Collins. I wrote a couple of songs. Hmm. And we give them kind of a big band treatment as well.
Well, let's people hear what you're talking about. Here we go.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should do.
And that track called I Won't Dance from your new album called I've Got Your Number. And you know, tell us about, for people who've only maybe been familiar with your career as an actor, tell us about the singing side of it. How did that get started?
Well, I've been singing since I was a little kid, and I had great teachers at Lodi ever since I was in elementary school. They kind of took care of me and took me under their wing. And I studied voice at the University of Wisconsin, so I've been a singer kind of forever.
Oh, it's interesting. I went there to study voice, too. Interesting. So how did you get...
What year? You were there after I was there. I started in 1969.
Yeah, that's after me, but I'm not going to say what year because I don't want people calculating my age. But who did you study with back then?
I studied with Dale Gilbert.
Okay.
Who actually ended up being head of the music school for a number of years. A really terrific guy. He actually I think he was in school with Cheryl Milnes, who's a renowned bass baritone from the Chicago Lyric Opera.
Nice. Well, you've had kind of a dream career. You've gotten to do some of everything. You were on a hit TV show. You've been on Broadway. You've gotten to release albums in different genres. How did you get there from UW-Madison, if you want to give advice to people who are trying to do the same thing?
Can't keep a job, you know? I keep pushing at it, you know? It's one of those things where, I mean, actually, you know, right now I've got a little bit of vocal trauma. I've been dealing with not an infection, but an inflammation of the vocal cords. So it's kind of put me off my game a little bit. But mostly, I mean, I work pretty constantly. And I don't know. I stick at it. Fortunately for me, I've had different opportunities in the different parts of the business. And I've been able to take advantage of them. And I've had good people working with me. I've always had great musicians around me and really good, fine producers. And I've been fortunate to have really good representation as far as agents and managers go as well.
Well, you're living in Manhattan now. You said you spend a lot of your time in Manhattan. You perform a lot in New York. What do people say when you tell them you're from Wisconsin?
They don't care.
They don't care. Come on, I want some reaction. At least they know about cheese and beer, right?
Yeah, you know, Packers, too.
Pretty good
subject. Actually, there's a bar near there where I go to watch Brewers games and Packers and Badgers. They play. There's a bar on the Upper West Side. And you run into a lot of people, actually. The Wisconsin sports fans are rabid, and they're everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you never really go too long without seeing them, and Manhattan is no exception. It's, you know, they've been very nice to me in New York, but I still have really strong connections to Wisconsin. I own my father's farm up in Lodi still, and my stepmom lives in Lodi, and I have a brother in Lodi and a brother in Milwaukee.
Oh, okay.
So I get home as much as I can. I was actually there last week to see the Brewers play and lose another one.
Yeah, it might not be the best season for that, but yeah.
They've had a tough year.
They had
a tough year, but I think it's a character-building year. I think they're going to be great next year. They've brought up a lot of really fine young players, and I think they're going to have a real transitional year next year.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are hoping that you are right about that, and are
feeling
the same way.
Well, the Badgers this year are going to be awesome. Packers too. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
And the Bucks are starting over. I think they've made a nice adjustment in their situation and geared toward a younger team. I think they're going to be better. I mean, you know, I don't mean to dwell on sports, but it's one of my passions.
Yeah, I can tell you're from Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, I'm very fond of my Wisconsin sports teams,
yeah.
And I'm proud of them, too.
Well, that's good to hear, even a good old boy like you, still keeping the Wisconsin roots alive. Now, this album, to get back to your album, we could keep talking sports, but I do want to talk about your career. You're singing kind of jazz style on this. And
I understand it. I've been doing this now for about 15 years. When I did Annie Get Your Gun, I started in 98 working with Bernadette. And when we made the Cast album in 99, the people at Angel Records asked me if I wanted to make a jazz record. And I had done country before. I'd never done jazz. And we did the, you know, kind of a country pop, country rock kind of thing. But the jazz was just a nice fit. And the more that I've worked on it, the more that it fits my voice. And it's just something that seems to come naturally to me. And I very much enjoy it. And also what we do, too, is like, there are performers out there like Diana Krall and say, Diane Reeves, who take and on their jazz records, they mix in a lot of contemporary and rock and roll stuff that they give a jazz treatment. And that's really what we've tried to do as well.
Well, let's listen to another little bit. This is the title track called I've Got Your Number.
I've got your number. I know you inside out. You ain't no Eagle Scout. You're all at sea. Oh, yes, you brag a lot. Wave your own.
And can you tell us a little bit about that particular track as a title track?
Yeah, well, that's a song that was written by Cy Coleman and Carolyn Lee. And Cy was actually a friend. I knew Cy. I met him back in 1978 when I first came to New York. And I did a musical of his called I Love My Wife, which the title track is a really nice record. And Sinatra recorded a version of I Love My Wife, the song. But I worked with Cy on several different musicals. There was one when I came back after Dukes. I did a musical called The City of Angels. And I remember one day in particular that I sat down with him and a couple of other actors, and he showed us basically how to sing swing. And it was the coolest thing ever. So this is a song that I think really reflects the era, the early 60s. And also, you know, I mean, between he and Carolyn Lee, there was a certain, I don't know, frisson, a certain tension.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it to listeners to listen to the album and get the rest of the story. We're out of time, but Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a treat to talk to you.
All right, my pleasure. Anytime.
All right, that was Tom Wopat, Broadway singer and star of the 1970s TV show The Dukes of Hazzard.
If you have a suggestion for a future Wisconsin Legend segment, post it on the Central Time Facebook page or leave us a message toll-free 855-683-5422.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll take a look at the invention of the bleep. You know, that's a noise we have to play when someone swears, says something they shouldn't on the radio, and what the bleep says about modern censorship in America.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out why typewriters are still in use at some businesses across the country and why some business owners say they couldn't live without them.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the program, we'll explore the world of jam bands and the fans who love them.
But first, in a world where we're surrounded by computers, laptops, smartphones, and tablets, it's almost quaint to think that the typewriter could still play a role in today's economy.
But believe it or not, a few industries in particular are still reliant on the loyal typewriter, and they're keeping the few remaining typewriter manufacturers in business.
Laura Cosisto joins us now. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, recently found out who's keeping the typewriter alive. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So we don't see typewriters around that often, but in your piece you say there's a great place to find them where they're still being used. Where is that?
Well, one of the places that I first found them actually was funeral homes, of all places, that they still use them to type out death certificates, which I found totally surprising. That's how I found the story and started to dig into it and realize that there were other places like prisons and police departments that also use them.
So why does the funeral industry need typewriters in this day and age?
Well, so they are really reliant on at the state level for the health department to institute an electronic death registry. And even many funeral directors and funeral director associations I talk to are willing to pay for the implementation of an electronic death registry. But it takes time to set up. You know, it takes legislation. And so in a handful of states, that's just dragged on for years and years, and they are still required to use typewriters.
And so they're still clinging on to these typewriters. They don't want to, it sounds like.
No, definitely not. I told one story in my story about them having to, because they need to get a doctor's signature on the manual certificates, about them going out to a golf course and intercepting a doctor on like the 18th tee to get a signature.
Oh boy. So they're wanting to move into the modern day and age too.
Yes.
But they're not able to at this point. Or are they? Is there something happening that's going to move them away from the typewriter?
Definitely. There was actually a change in New York State, where I'm based, and they just changed the law. And knock on wood, they hope that means that they'll put in place an electronic death registry. But there are other places like Connecticut where they changed the law and then, you know, just had sort of technological meltdowns. And it turned out that just using a typewriter was easier in the end.
And now there's still a typewriter industry that relies on the places you talked about, funeral homes and others, to need to keep using them.
Indeed, I would call it a teeny tiny industry of one. I found one company in New Jersey that still makes typewriters and still sells them, does a business of a few thousand a year. And as far as I can tell, they're the only ones left, actually.
Are you nostalgic at all for the typewriter? I mean, my grandma had a typewriter, and I can remember her teaching me how to use the little bottle of Whiteout and how to, you know, hit the carriage return. It made all of these satisfying sounds. You know, when you hit the buttons, it felt very satisfying, too. I don't know. I kind of miss the typewriter, but I wouldn't necessarily want it back or anything.
Yes.
But I'm glad that someone's still using it. Do you feel the same way?
You know, I had this whimsical idea that I would write this story on a typewriter, and I sat down at one and I tried to do it, and you forget how slowly, because I used one when I was a kid, but you forget how slowly you have to type, and I got frustrated after about 20 minutes, and that was it.
Well, it seems like filling out forms kept it alive for a long time. In fact, in the hallway over here, moreover in Wisconsin Public Television land, there was this rickety table with a typewriter, and every now and then you'd see somebody unergonomically leaning or crouching over to type and I think fill out grant applications or something. And gradually the technology is changing where you can fill out more and more forms online. So less and less excuse for most of us to keep that typewriter around.
You know, but it's funny, and I talked to an expert about this who said that, you know, new technologies come about, but they often, there's one or two functions that they're really slow to evolve to do. And I thought about the experience of filling out a form online, right, like that PDF form and how frustrating it is. And it sort of made some sense to me that if you were filling out a ton of forms every day, it might be easier just to bang them out, but which was really interesting.
Well, it was interesting that, you know, the funeral industry is one place where you found the typewriter still alive and kicking, but another place is prisons. So
yes.
Why are typewriters still going strong in prisons?
Because, you know, computers are just a lot easier to tamper with if you're clever and have a lot of time on your hands, even if they disable the internet ostensibly. You know, it just, there were concerns it would just be too easy for prisoners to hack into them to create a program, and also hard to see if something was being smuggled inside the computer. And so Swintech got this idea that they would make clear typewriters, much as there are clear toothbrushes and that sort of thing in prisons. And they still do a really good business, actually. Prisoners, even though they're pretty expensive, you know, hundreds of dollars, still save up money from, you know, their very, very low-paying jobs and buy typewriters to keep themselves amused.
And you also mentioned in your piece one of the last places I've seen a typewriter in popular culture, The Wire, and police officers there in the Baltimore Police Department doing some two-fingered typing to do their reports for the day. But a lot of police are still using these things, right?
I couldn't believe that, actually. I got the idea from thinking, oh, where have I seen these? And I thought, oh, The Wire, and called around, and same thing, you know, Philadelphia, they've looked at trying to do an electronic system, and it just is really time-consuming. And actually, I had a great story from Toronto that I didn't have room for about how when they tried to take the typewriters away, they had to lock them in a room because the police officers just did not want to use computers.
I don't know what to think about that. They don't want to save time. And they, I don't know. I guess it's more complicated than that. And maybe they like the feel of it and filling out those documents, like you just said.
Yeah, something like that. Because certainly the typewriters I wrote about were not the pretty ones like your, it sounds like your grandmother had. These were these hefty 80s and 90s, you know, machines that were not beautiful, but people still sort of have an attachment to them.
So there's something gritty about the typewriter then. I'm seeing it in The Wire. It makes sense. You know, it doesn't seem like it would be as cool to see a gritty police officer
with a laptop.
On a laptop. Yeah.
So, and the machines these people are using, I mean, these are pretty high tech, right? It's not the old manual. You got to push really hard to make the key strike. And these are, you know, word processors almost, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, one of the models that Swintech, the company in New Jersey, briefly saw some popularity with was a typewriter that was actually hooked up to a computer screen, and then it would print everything out at the end. But the advantage, I guess, that people, his secretary still uses it, and the advantage that people see is that you're not distracted by Facebook, and you're not distracted by email, and you can just sit there and type things out. And that seems to still have an appeal for people.
Laura, as laws change and technology keeps on moving forward, do you see the typewriter fading away, even these niche markets you were talking about, or do you think there's still going to be a market that exists for them?
You know, it's a really interesting question. It seems so hard to believe that it would continue to persist, if nothing else, because I think it's getting increasingly hard for people to find parts. I was amazed after I wrote the story how many people emailed me the next day and said, "Could you help me find a ribbon for my typewriter?"
So you have a new career as typewriter helper person.
Exactly.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem at all. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Laura Cusisto, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Her piece, "Death Keeps Typewriters Alive, Clacking," is linked to on the Central Time Facebook page.
You know, this kind of reminds me of the transition in the radio world from cutting audio tape to digital editing on a computer.
Cutting audio tape with a razor blade.
With a razor blade, yes, right. And sometimes cutting ourselves. And it, I loved cutting tape. The transition was nice, but there were people I remember who resisted. They did not want to learn the new system, and they wanted to keep cutting tape. So, like the police having to have their typewriters locked up, kind of. And there's still that digital audio tape or that audio tape machine right over there. That I don't
the
reel
to reel machine.
The reel to reel. Thank
yeah,
you.
That's what that's, it's called.
It's not plugged into anything, though, I don't think.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think we use it from time to time, though.
Oh, okay. Well, I haven't seen it. Coming up next, a look at the jam band scene in America and the bands who ushered in a new era of music and crowd participation. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. From the Grateful Dead to Phish and beyond, jam bands have formed bonds with fans around the country, often at major music festivals.
Peter Connors is with us. His new book is Jamerica, the history of the jam band and festival scene. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, let's define our terms. What makes a band a jam band?
Well, I think at the heart of the jam band, there's a willingness to improvise live in concert. And in the book, I break down, you know, a couple different sort of subcategories of what makes a jam band. But I think at its heart, there has to be that willingness to improvise and play these live shows where they're musically going out on the high wire. And that's what the fans of the jam bands expect as well.
And it seems like, and when I've heard people talk about bands, we're going to name some names in a few minutes. You know, when you hear a track, say a studio track from the Grateful Dead, that doesn't really count. Those recorded albums aren't the thing the fans are there for. It's the live performances.
That's right. And the Grateful Dead were, of course, you know, really made their name and spread across the country through what we call bootleg tapes. And they actually allowed taping at their concerts, which, you know, is still sort of a rarity and is something else that sets the jam band scene apart. A lot of these bands encourage fans to come, often with very high-quality recording gear, and record each night's show and to share it with each other. And it used to be, you know, by sending tapes through the mail, and of course now it's all moved online. But that's really the heart of the scene, is those live performances that, again, the bands love when the fans, you know, trade those and talk about them, and that forms a heart of the jam band culture.
I was going to say, I knew people who would meet up with other people and trade tapes, you know, dub each other's tapes. How big a deal has the internet been with sharing those bootleg shows?
Well, I think it's been revolutionary, you know, as the internet has been with so many things. The jam band scene and the Grateful Dead scene before that has always been a grassroots community that depends on people, you know, connecting with each other over their love of the bands. And so, of course, the internet just facilitates that and plays right into that so well. So whether it's fans trading, you know, tapes or links to shows, online, I should say recordings, not tapes, of course, trading those links online and letting each other know where the best recordings are, or just getting in touch about the shows and sort of talking about them after, you know, they occur. It's been a real boon to the community.
Let's give a listen to the Grateful Dead. This is a little instrumental clip mostly, I think. So the big deal and the reason people follow a band like the Dead is that tonight's show, they might play a song, and tomorrow night they might play the same song, and it might be very different. How much variation is there from one night to the next playing the same song?
Right. Well, one thing I should say is it would be very rare for them to play the same song two nights in a row.
Okay.
So that was part of it. And of course, you know, a band like the Grateful Dead had such a deep catalog, they could go many, many shows without replaying a show. But, you know, there were especially these improvisational passages that were just built into the songs. So as opposed to just having, you know, verse, chorus, verse type of structure, there was always room built into the songs for these deep improvisational explorations that could perhaps lead to a completely different song and then sometimes back into the original song. And again, that's sort of the point of the jam band scene, is letting the musicians go into those passages, musically play off of each other, and find out where the music's going to go. And you'll hear in the book a lot of musicians and also fans describe that as a journey, which in many ways it is. It's an oral journey that they take together.
Now, you've written this book, Jamerica. Your previous book was Growing Up Dead, and I gather it's about you in your teen years as a Deadhead. What got you as a teenager into the Grateful Dead?
Well, it was the tapes, you know, and that for a lot of people, that was their first encounter with the Grateful Dead. I had, you know, a couple friends who got some tapes through older siblings, and then we started passing them around. And I was just really interested. Now, this was in 1985, was my first real encounter with the band. So the music scene was, of course, very different, you know, at that time. And so the Grateful Dead was like an alien ship, you know, landing landing in my ears. You know, what are these guys and what are they playing? And it just didn't sound like anything else I had heard, but I was very intrigued with it. And so I just sort of got deeper and deeper, and I listened more and more. And the song, you know, a lot of times with the band, there's a particular song or a particular moment when you just get hooked. And for me, it was a song called Ripple by the Grateful Dead that had lyrics by their main lyricist, Robert Hunter. And it was just such a beautiful song. And it was, there was an otherworldly, you know, quality to what they were producing. And it just hooked me in. And then I went to my first concert, as we called it, in Grateful Dead World Show, a couple of years later, and I was, as we say, on the bus. I was fully into the Grateful Dead.
And it seems like, you mentioned, it's like an alien ship compared to a lot of the other music. The typical pattern is there's a rock musician, you buy their CD, you maybe go see them when they come through town. It seems like there's a way more of a community element with the jam band. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, there is. You know, and again, you can sort of go back to the Grateful Dead with this. But especially in the late 80s, you were able to travel from show to show, and a lot of times they would book their tours so that there was only, you know, an hour or two of road travel time between them. So you could go from show to show, but you could also set up in the parking lot. You could sleep in the parking lot. You know, you could make grilled cheese sandwiches, or you could make tie-dye shirts or artwork or whatever it might be, and you could actually sell it in the parking lot, and you could make your money to then go to the next show. And so there was this real sense of community, particularly among the people who would tour and follow the Grateful Dead. And you still see that now. And I think, you know, an interesting part of the jam band scene is a lot of these bands and also the fans have picked the things that worked the best in the Grateful Dead community, and they've carried it over into their own band scene. And so you'll see people still, you know, selling necklaces or whatever it might be at festivals, even if, you know, there's no Grateful Dead involvement whatsoever. And that was part of what interested me, really, and made me want to delve deeper into the modern-day jam band and festival scene, is to see how these ideas have evolved and how people, you know, get into them and carry them over.
I want to move on to some of those other bands in just a minute, but here's a true or false for you. The Grateful Dead are the founders of the jam band scene. True or false?
I wouldn't say founders. I actually put them as a step before the jam band scene. I think they were sort of... They were so much at the beginning that you can't really lump them into the larger jam band scene. And that's a point that I lay out in the introduction of the book as well. I really wanted to give credit to what you might consider the next generation, or to me, the first generation of jam bands, which was, you know, Blues Traveler and Widespread Panic and Phish and a whole bunch of different bands. But they, again, picked up some of the things that the Grateful Dead had done. And then they started this whole wave of the modern jam band scene that's still going on very strong today.
Let's get into some of those guys. I have a clip of Blues Travelers ready to go. This is Run Around.
Oh, once upon a midnight deer, you woke with something in my head. Couldn't escape that memory.
So do people follow the Blues Travelers from show to show like they did for the Grateful Dead?
I don't know that the Blues Traveler has such a following from show to show, but you know what's happening now is it's less about following, other than Phish, which sort of has their own whole scene that really rivals the Grateful Dead in many ways. A lot of what you see is there's so many of these festivals going on around the country that as opposed to following one particular band, you'll see the kids going from festival to festival where there's going to be, you know, 20 different bands on the bill, and maybe a handful of them are, you know, their favorite bands. But then they get exposed to all this other music as well and all these different bands. So I think it's more, as far as the traveling and going show to show, I think it's really morphed into being more about the festivals.
When did those festivals get started, the that mainly focus on the jam bands, I should say?
Yeah, I think that the Horde tours were the first ones to really get that going. So this is 1991, 1992, and they were really organized mainly by John Popper of Blues Traveler in close association with Bill Graham Productions. And, of course, Bill Graham was a legendary promoter and created the Fillmore West and East and was a seminal figure in the 60s rock scene. And his son, David Graham, was managing Blues Traveler. And so as a result of that, Blues Traveler was sort of at the helm of organizing these shows called the Horde Tours. Horde stood for Horizons of Rock Developing Everywhere. And that was the first time you saw on a large national scale bands going out together who, you know, have created great names for themselves now, which was Blues Traveler and Widespread Panic and Phish, Spin Doctors, Bela Fleck was in there. So a lot of different bands that have gone on to do very interesting things. But I think you have to look at Horde as the first of these modern-day festivals.
I want to talk about Phish for a few minutes, and we'll go out with a clip from them in a few minutes. But when I think jam band, that is the name that pops into my head. Are they the dominant figure in that generation you mentioned of jam bands?
Yeah, I think undoubtedly. I mean, anytime you have a band, you know, that is basically off mainstream, let's say radio radar, in a lot of ways, you know, mainstream music industry radar, but can sell out four nights at Madison Square Garden on New Year's Eve, you know, in a heartbeat. You have a force to be reckoned with. And so I really think that, you know, as far as the size of their following, the dedication of their following, the way that people pay attention to Phish has really made them, you know, the next step after the Grateful Dead.
Is that part of the appeal to fans that these are bands that kind of, in a way, you know, this band came to me. It wasn't mediated by the record label, and they just went out and built their own connections with the community?
I think it is. Yeah, I think that, you know, there's always going to be a segment of people who are looking for something that those around them have not yet discovered or that hasn't been fed to them by other, you know, media outlets or by the radio stations, you know, what they're playing, those top 10 songs they're playing every 5 minutes and so forth. And, you know, again, once you get into that, then that sort of becomes your community as well, and that becomes part of your social circle. So you find other people who are kindred spirits who also like this music, and you might talk to them about it, and you might end up traveling to shows with them. And I think there's a real appeal not just in the music, but also in finding your way into that subculture.
You know, I've read things by Matt Groening, the TV show Freaks and Geeks, things like The Grateful Dead and then later jam bands. It seems like they present a home away from home for people who don't really feel connected with the community they're growing up in. Do you think it provides that outlet for a lot of people?
Yeah, I think it does. And, you know, one thing that I think is overlooked a lot of times in these scenes, too, is there's an alternative education that takes place when you get into these scenes. And for me personally, I was, you know, a young person as a teenager. I was interested in writing, but I hadn't had tremendous success or acceptance in, you know, the traditional school system. So for me, when I got into the Grateful Dead and I started listening to their lyrics, and they might refer to a beat character, say Neil Cassady, you know, who's Dean Moriarty and On the Road, you know, that sort of led me to go, well, who is this? You know, and then I would read about that person, and then I would discover, you know, Jack Kerouac, and he might have referred to Dostoevsky or Celine or these different people. So for me, there was a huge educational component. It opened up this whole new world of learning that really benefited me as a writer. And I think that's something worth looking at, too, that a lot of times these kids are just not having their intellectual needs met through traditional channels, and they may find, you know, the outlets or the experiences that they have on the road to be more intellectually stimulating than what they're faced with.
Talking to Peter Connors. His book is Jamerica, The History of the Jam Band and Festival Scene. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We're going to bring up some music by Phish now, and I want to know, did you follow the Grateful Dead? Have you been to shows? Or Phish? Or some of the other bands we're talking about or will talk about, like String Cheese Incident, Spin Doctors, Blues Travelers? Is this a home away from home with you, the festival scene? 800-642-1234. We'll take your calls after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.